Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome. Thank you for joining us for the November 2019 NYSAR webinar. We wanted to take a moment to remind everyone that today is National Rural Health Day, and as the Power of Rural website says, it's not just a day, it's a movement. Be sure to check out the Power of Rural website to see how you can get involved. We are scheduled to run today from 1 p.m. to 2 p.m. We apologize for the technical issues and getting started late. We kindly ask that everyone mute their mics so that we avoid any background noise and interruptions. The title of today's webinar is How the New York Health Act Will Improve the Health of Rural New Yorkers, and our speaker today is Dr. Henry Moss, board member for the Physicians for a National Health Program, New York Metro Chapter. Henry Moss is a retired educator doing independent academic and public policy research and writing. He has a PhD in philosophy with an emphasis on social theory, and his policy interests include healthcare, housing and urban development, technological progress, and social democratic politics. In 2015, he self-published a book on long-term care, The 2030 Caregiving Crisis, A Heavy Burden for Boomer Children. He joined Physicians for a National Health Program to bring greater attention to long-term care issues in the single-payer Medicare for All movement and to help advocate for national and state single-payer legislation. He is currently on the board of the New York Metro Chapter. In a moment, I'll be turning it over to Dr. Moss. However, I wanted you to know that after the presentation, he will be entertaining questions from webinar participants. Please feel free to type your questions into the chat window, or we will take questions directly from webinar participants at the end of the presentation. I will facilitate the Q&A portion with the remaining time available. One more quick reminder to mute your mics. And now, Dr. Moss, I turn it over to you. Thank you. Dr. Moss, you are on mute. Please unmute yourself. There you go.
Thank you, Karen. The New York Health Act is legislation that's been introduced into the New York State Assembly, Bill 548. It's passed the assembly by 2-1 margins four times. It's one vote short in the Senate, where it's known as Bill 3577. The sponsors of the bill are hopeful that in 2020, we'll get that last senator. There are four or five senators who have not yet signed on, but who expressed support for the bill, but still have questions and issues in, you know, dealing with such a dramatic change in how we deliver healthcare in New York. Should it pass both houses, it'll then end discussion with the governor's office, and governors expressed general interest in the legislation, sees it as an aspiration, but still has a lot of questions as to whether it can be feasibly done in New York State. So what I'd like to do today is briefly talk about why this legislation is needed in terms of the current healthcare systems in the United States and in New York. Then I'd like to talk briefly about the principles of New York Health, and then how it's going to be paid for, and finally ways in which we'll help the health of rural New Yorkers. So it's not moving, Fran. The slide's not advancing, Karen.
Can you hit enter or space?
I'm doing both.
All right, let me.
I'm hitting escape and it's not coming out of the slide.
All right, let me see if I can open the a moment. I'll open your PowerPoint.
She's trying to get her own version up.
Could you go to slideshow? She's.
We up? Ah, there we go.
All right, just let me know when to advance, Dr. Moss.
Okay, so symptoms of a broken healthcare system. Advance. This slide speaks for itself. If you look at the red bar, that's the cost per capita of total healthcare spending in the United States, over $10,000 per person. If you look at the last bar, the gray one, the average of OECD nations, those of advanced nations, Europe, Japan, and so forth, it's about 4,000. So we spend about twice as much on healthcare in the United States as we spend in other countries. Next. Looked at over time, you could see that back in 1980, we were pretty much together with most of the other advanced countries. Those countries have moved forward and costs have been going up. They've been going up gradually. The United States is the red line on top. Costs have been going up much faster in the United States, and the gap between us and the other advanced nations is growing larger. Next. In New York State, you can see this phenomena in the premium costs for a typical private employer-based health insurance plan. In 2008, single coverage was $4,600. 2017, it went up to $7,000. Family coverage went from $12,000 to $21,000. These are increases of better than 50, 60%. The employee share of those premiums has also gone up. In the case of family coverage, the premiums have gone up 74%. And over these 10 years, inflation has only gone up 15%. So that shows you what it means in terms of premiums in New York State. Next. So what are we getting for all this money? Well, our healthcare outcomes are not only not any better than these other advanced countries, but it's actually a bit worse. Total life expectancy at birth. If you look at the chart, you'll see that other countries have been steadily rising in their life expectancy. But you might notice that in 2010, the United States has leveled off. And over the last 4 or 5 years, the United States has actually been declining. Now, life expectancy is not obviously not the only way to measure health. But in many, many other areas, including maternal health and child health, the numbers are similar. Next, please. The Commonwealth Fund issues a report every year comparing healthcare systems in 11 major countries. As you can see from this chart, the United States is rated 11th out of 11 in the overall ranking. It's rated dead last in access. It's rated last in equity. It's rated last in healthcare outcomes. It's rated next to last in administrative efficiency. And the only area where the United States comes in better than average is in the area of care process, which is a way of saying that our doctors are competent, our hospitals are do a good job, and the actual process of healthcare is adequate, in fact, superior in the United States. Nonetheless, we rank last in terms of the overall healthcare system. Next, please. This is an extremely important measure of what's going on in our healthcare system. It's called underinsurance. This is basically what happens to people who actually have insurance, but who don't have enough insurance, who don't have good enough insurance. Underinsurance is measured by anyone who's got an out-of-pocket expense, cash expenses, greater than 10% of their income, or if they're low income, greater than 5% of their income. And then you can see, when we talk about out-of-pocket expenses, we're talking about deductibles, co-payments, and other cash payments that have to be made. You can see that in 2003, 2005, we were people with insurance, 12 to 13% were considered underinsured. By 2016, 28% of people are considered underinsured. Next slide, please. In New York State, this kind of thing shows up when you look at employer plan deductibles. The deductibles people have to pay before they see any benefit from insurance, even if they have a healthcare plan from their employer. In 2008, 46% of employees even had deductibles. By 2017, 75% had deductibles. More importantly, the average deductible for individuals has gone from $732 a year to $1,687 per year, 130% increase. The average deductible for families has grown from $1,500 to over $3,000. We're talking here average, which means there are plans that have $4,000, $5,000, $6,000 deductibles. In other words, you don't see a penny from the insurance company until you've met your annual deductible. So that's grown by 111%. And once again, inflation over that period of time has grown only 15%. Next slide. What does this mean? Well, studies have shown that the underinsured put off care. 41% of the underinsured have put off care each year. What do we mean by put off care? Well, maybe they didn't go to a doctor when they should have. Well, maybe they didn't go to the follow-up doctor. They didn't take a test, a medical diagnostic test when they were told that they should do it. Or maybe they didn't fill a prescription. Or maybe they filled a prescription, but they cut the pills in half to make it last longer. This is what's known as putting off care. And 41% of the people who are classified as underinsured have put off care every year. And 49% of these uninsured report that they have trouble paying medical bills. In addition, studies have shown that upwards of 25 or 30,000 people a year in the United States end up dying from preventable illness because they didn't have the ability financially to access healthcare. And the number of people the majority of people who go bankrupt every year report that medical expenses or medical bills were the major part of their problem. Next, please. Okay, so that's the problem. I think most of you are aware of that. Most of everything you're hearing on television these days points to the problem in the United States and in New York. So let's look at how the New York Health Act will work, and then we'll talk about how we're going to pay for it. Next. Okay, the first foundational principle of the legislation is that healthcare is a right, not a privilege. From the New York State Constitution, quote, "The protection and promotion of the health of the inhabitants of the state are matters of public concern," unquote. And from the legislation's introduction preamble, quote, "The legislature finds and declares that all residents of the state have the right to health care," unquote. Next, please. Next. Okay, the first principle is universal coverage. That means every resident of the state of New York, that is to say, everyone domiciled here, anyone with a lease or a phone bill or a Con Ed bill or a rental agreement is covered. And that would include both legally situated immigrants as well as undocumented immigrants. We'll talk more about undocumented immigrants later, but two things are fairly obvious, that if an undocumented immigrant is very, very sick, they're gonna end up in an emergency room at a public hospital that's required to take them. And the second point is that it's fairly obvious that an undocumented immigrant who starts out with a minor healthcare concern risks for that concern to become a major one, and will be not only life-threatening potentially, but obviously very costly. It's a big mistake to not cover undocumented immigrants. Second principle is that there will be no premiums or coinsurance and no deductibles or copays. And Medicare premiums would be assumed by the state, and the same for Medicare deductibles and copays. New York Health would wrap around Medicare. Why do we do that? Why do we say that as a principle? The sponsors of the bill say that how we pay for healthcare should be separated from actually getting healthcare. In other words, financial consideration should not stand in the way of actually getting necessary health care. If you're going to finance your healthcare system, do it separately. But someone should be able to walk into a doctor's office or a hospital and expect to get treatment for a medically necessary condition without someone asking them if they have insurance or if they have cash or a bill. In every major advanced country, Europe, Japan, Korea, Australia, they get a card and they walk into a medical facility or a healthcare facility and they get treated. The issue of how they're going to pay for it is separate. We should have the same here. Next, please. The next principle is that this whole plan will be publicly funded by the state. The counties would no longer contribute based upon local property taxes. Next. Another principle, there'll be no provider network restrictions. You can use any doctor, any clinic, and any hospital that you find to either be convenient or appropriate for your medical treatment. You'd be determining which you want to do based upon how quickly they can treat you, how quickly they can see you, or what their reputation is, or how conveniently they are located, but there will be no narrow networks. Next. Next principle is that no one could sell coverage that duplicates any New York health benefit. Rich and poor will use the same system. In other words, there'll be no commercial insurance permitted that would sell the same coverage. Governor Cuomo's health insurance, the legislators' health insurance, and wealthy people in the city of New York's health insurance will be the same health insurance being used by working people and middle-class people throughout the state. Value of that is that if the rich and the well-placed are using the same system that the rest of us are using, you can be assured that they will see to it that the system is a good one. Next, please. This is important. The New York Health Act is offering comprehensive benefits. Things like dental, optical, hearing, preventive care, mental health care in parity with physical health care, and full prescription drug coverage are all included in the legislation. And in the 2019 bill, long-term care was added to the benefits package. And that's long-term care, whether that's in a nursing home or through a personal care assistant, home care aide, working in the home of someone who is disabled, frail, chronically ill, cognitively impaired, or disabled. Next, please. So the question we always get, of course, is how are we going to pay for such a comprehensive program? It's going to be getting many more people, the uninsured and the underinsured, covered. And this, of course, is the big question that everyone's always asking in terms of the feasibility of this kind of a program. So there are basically three parts to how we're going to pay for the program. The first part, next please, is savings. The administration of the plan would be by the state, and the state's administrative expenses would be dramatically lower than the administrative expenses that are currently incurred by insurance companies. And health economists that we've worked with estimate you can get as much as $20 billion in annual savings by reducing health plan administration. Next. You can reduce provider administration costs. In Canada, a hospital will have maybe a dozen or two dozen billing and insurance clerks in their administrative office because they're only dealing with a single payer, the Canadian government or the provincial government. In the United States, that same hospital of that same size can have as many as 300 or 400 billing and insurance clerks because they've got to deal with hundreds of different insurance companies, thousands of different plans, thousands of different drug formularies. All of those change all the time. Each healthcare insurer has a different type of computer system, different administrative systems. There's prior authorizations, there's claim denials. All of this is a huge expense. The estimation by the health economists is we could save up to $16 billion in reduced administrative costs in hospitals and in doctor's offices. Next. And finally, we can get reduced prices for drugs and devices, maybe $18 billion in savings. As some of you may be aware, Medicare cannot negotiate for lower drug prices. We and commercial insurance companies don't negotiate very hard with pharmaceutical companies for lower drug prices. They prefer to pass it along to the consumer. But everybody else negotiates. The Veterans Administration, Medicaid, spends substantially less than the rest of the American healthcare system on drugs, and as do the Europeans and other advanced nations. So the estimation is we could save as much as $18 billion if we negotiated with drug companies on behalf of 20 million residents of New York State. Next. So just quickly reviewing that, if you see on the left, the Medicare administrative costs, about 2% of revenue. You can see the administrative costs for insurance companies, Aetna, Humana, United Healthcare, and the rest, as well, up to 17%. Why? Well, they have to pay huge executive salaries. They have to pay for marketing. They have to account for profit. And they have to account for those thousands of workers who negotiate with providers every day to force them to either accept a care denial or to prove that healthcare is needed. Next. And just as a quick estimate, this is a research paper that showed that physician office expenses in the United States are almost four times higher than they are in Canada. Because in Canada, they don't need to have four people in the back office managing the administrative aspects of private healthcare, private health insurance. It's all done through a single computerized system that links to the Canadian or the provincial administration. Next. And then on drugs, you can see that the United States spends far more than other advanced nations per capita on prescription drugs. Next. So that's part one of how to finance the New York Health Act. The second part is that we'll continue to receive the money that would go to Medicare recipients and that would go to the federal portion of Medicaid and other federal subsidies, including the Affordable Care Act, reimbursable tax subsidies. Next. And the remaining expense that will be needed to expand healthcare, to offer all these new benefits, to offer long-term care, will be in the form of a payroll tax, a progressive payroll tax based upon the ability to pay. In the legislative language, it would be a payroll tax paid 80% by employers and 20% by employees. Most employers in the state will still save money with the 80%. And there'll be further graduated tax assessments on upper bracket non-payroll income, such as capital gains, rents, interest, and dividends. In other words, if your income is low, you'll be paying less. If your income is high and you have a lot of upper bracket non-payroll income, you'll be paying more. So what will that mean? Well, the RAND Corporation, next please. I'm sorry. Can you go back one, Karen? Okay, continue forward. Okay, a health economist put together a sample tax schedule that would meet these criteria. And just as an example, they came up with no taxes under $25,000 annual income. And that's written into the bill. $900 a year if you earn $50,000 annually, $1,800 a year if you earn $75,000, and $2,700 a year if you earn $100,000. It's a pretty low effective rate. The employer's rate's obviously going to be higher. Next, please. But New York State asked the RAND Corporation to study the New York Health Act economics. I don't know if you know the RAND Corporation. They're out of Stanford University. They're considered perhaps the most respected health economist research entity in the country, possibly the world. New York State spent $400,000 asking them for a report on the New York Health Act. And we agreed with some of their conclusions. We disagree with others, but we're very happy about this conclusion, where RAND says that among New Yorkers with household compensation below the 90th percentile under the status quo in 2022, the average household compensation of $105,000, healthcare payments would decrease by about $2,800 per person. Some obviously will be decreased by more, some will decrease by less. But what they said was that up 90% of the New York State population will see healthcare payments on average be less. I'm sorry, the taxes that we're contemplating on average would be less than what they would pay on average for healthcare in a given year. And that this doesn't include long-term care, so that number 2,800 might be lower. And the plan is to increase payments to providers to bring up Medicaid rates and bring up Medicare rates. So that would also bring that down. But you can see from RAND's report that this is not going to cost individuals more, but it will in fact cost individuals less. Next, please. Okay, this is real quick. I just want to, a lot of people are concerned about Medicare. I just want to point out that Medicare doesn't go away under this system. Medicare will continue. Older adults will continue to have their Medicare card, but New York State will reimburse the premiums for Medicare Parts B and C and D, and New York State will wrap around and cover all of their deductibles and copayments. Next. There won't be any need for Medigap coverage. There won't be any need for Medicare Advantage. And there won't be any out-of-pocket spending for uncovered expenses that currently exist in traditional Medicare. Next. And the New York Health Program will basically seamlessly integrate Medicare into the process. And older adults will not lose any benefits. In fact, they will gain substantially. Next. And a brief note on long-term care. The sponsors added long-term care as a universal benefit in 2019 with an emphasis on home and community-based care rather than in institutions. Next. Disabled older adults will no longer have to impoverish themselves to access a personal care assistant or a nursing home through Medicaid. Next. Disabled younger adults will no longer have to forego higher education and careers in order to be poor enough to qualify for Medicaid long-term services and supports. Next. And family members will no longer have to reduce work hours or quit jobs to care for a disabled relative. We're really happy with the long-term care addition, and we think that may be what pushes this legislation over the top. So our final section here. How will the New York Health Act improve the health of rural New Yorkers? Next. We did a report on health in rural New York, and that report will be available in the archive for this video. If those of you who are interested in it, you'll be able to access our report. One of the things we termed in the report is that there are 1.3 million New Yorkers who live in rural areas, and that their physical and mental health status and life expectancy generally lag behind the rest of the state and the nation.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Next. We know that some of those reasons relate to poverty, low education levels, housing and food insecurity, isolation, and other social factors. We also know the population is aging rapidly as younger adults move away and the boomer generation grows old. Next. But there are two major factors that can be addressed directly by the New York Health Act. The first major factor is the financial barriers to healthcare access that we've been discussing. And the second, next, would be how the New York Health Act will improve provider and resource shortages, which are endemic in rural New York. Next. Okay, addressing financial barriers. Well, the first obvious one is uninsured will be covered. Right now, there are about 1 million uninsured in the state of New York. I would guess that in rural areas, the number is probably the proportionate share of that million. We did a study of Jefferson County, St. Lawrence County, and Lewis County. And even though uninsured have been going down dramatically from the Affordable Care Act, there are still uninsured people in rural areas. Second, it'll end under insurance. As we said before, the people who have insurance will no longer be facing deductibles, co-pays, and co-insurance and out-of-network charges that interfere with their ability to receive and maintain health care. Next. By providing comprehensive coverage, individuals in rural New York will no longer have to pay out of pocket for their dental, for their hearing, for their optical, for their mental health, drug addiction, okay, and for their drugs and medical devices. The legislation says that any service covered by Medicare, Medicaid, the Child Health Insurance Program, or the New York Public Employee Health Insurance Plans will be automatically covered by the New York Health Act. Next. And finally, the long-term care services will obviously benefit older adults and disabled adults in the rural areas of New York who need these services and who are having a great deal of difficulty receiving them. So that's the financial barriers. Next. Now, in terms of resource shortages, the New York Health Act will improve payment to healthcare providers. The New York Health commits this the state to fair negotiations with providers. Providers will be paid in full. I emphasize, providers will be paid in full. Unpaid medical debt is a huge problem in rural areas of New York because providers will treat people knowing full well that there'll be a balance. And then their ability to collect that balance is, of course, challenging. The New York Health Act will make sure providers are paid in full anywhere in the state. It also states that payment rates to providers shall be reasonably related to the cost of efficiently providing healthcare service and assuring an adequate and accessible supply of the healthcare service. There's no way that rural New York is going to have an adequate supply of services if it continues to pay its providers Medicaid rates and even Medicare reimbursement rates, which don't cover the cost of care. The sponsors of the New York Health Act are committed to bringing Medicaid rates and Medicare rates up to the level needed to be able to assure that there'll be an adequate supply of providers. In rural New York, this is a desperate situation. Many dentists don't take Medicaid, many physicians don't take Medicaid. And by bringing it up to the same rate throughout the state and making it high enough so that it covers the costs, there will be no longer, I can't get my health care because my doctor doesn't take Medicaid. Next. Increased resources for facilities. The New York Health will centralize the planning and financing of facilities with the state and will direct facility spending based on community need. The state will help finance the first MRI machine for a rural hospital before it finances the fifth one for a hospital on Fifth Avenue in New York City. In other words, the state will provide the addition, the credit, the loans, and the financing for the healthcare facilities where it is needed. And there are obviously a greater need in rural New York than there are in inner city New York City, in downtown Manhattan in New York City. And this bill will allow the state to be involved directly in financing what's needed. Next. Will create savings for counties and municipalities. Without the county property tax distribution to Medicaid, counties can use the free resources to expand essential services. And further resources will become available as county and local governments, public hospitals, schools,
holding pain,
the burden of providing health insurance for employees.
What about transportation?
There will be costs to the counties and municipalities and school boards and so on. But a lot of that burden will be taken off by the elimination of the county property tax and by the no longer needing to provide insurance for the state, for the public, county, public, and municipality employees. Next. And finally, it will improve the rural economy. If 90% of New Yorkers are spending less on taxes than they spend out of pocket for healthcare, and most small and mid-sized businesses will also see savings, a stimulative effect on local economies. There'll be more money in people's pockets, they'll spend more, more jobs will be created, and there will be a positive net impact to improving the rural economy. Next. Finally, I'm missing something there. I had a new slide in my own presentation. I just want to point out that the Campaign for New York Health has been going around the state asking people to tell their stories in writing and video and audio about how the current healthcare system has impacted them. And I had on a separate slide, which I can't show now, excerpts from two rural New Yorkers, one from Jefferson County and one from Allegheny County. One of them pointed out that she had a respiratory infection, but she was, this was before the ACA exchanges. She had respiratory infection, didn't have enough money to go to the doctor. It turned into pleurisy, and the pleurisy has damaged her respiratory system, and she now faces a lifetime limited function in her respiratory system because she couldn't afford to go to the doctor for a simple respiratory infection. The second story had to do with dental work. A woman in, I believe it was Jefferson County or Allegheny, had to search far and wide to find she was on Medicaid, had to search far and wide to find a dentist to repair a broken tooth of her child. It took a long time. They finally were able to find a dentist that could do it. However, she and her husband are still unable to find a dentist in their area who takes Medicaid. And as a result, they have to look for help from family and friends to pay dental service or wait for community dental services. With the New York Health Act, neither of those stories would ever happen again. If you have a respiratory infection, you'll get treated. If you need dental work, you'll get to see a dentist. Obviously, there's a shortage of dentists. We have to work on getting more dentists into the rural areas, but this bill at least gives us a chance to do it because it mandates that the state has assumed responsibility for that. For those of you who aren't already aware, poor dental health is a precursor to some of the worst types of healthcare nightmares: heart disease, renal disease, lung infections, all kinds of serious illnesses can result from untreated caries or untreated dental infections and untreated gum conditions. So when we're talking about getting dental care and finding a way to finance additional dentists in the rural areas, we're talking about something that is a potentially life and death situation for many rural residents. If you want more information about the New York Health Act or get a copy of our report or to get involved in building support for the New York Health Act, on the screen in front of you is the website for the Campaign for New York Health. The Physicians for a National Health Program work with that organization. Their New York headquarters, you want to contact Katie Robbins. Her email address is there. And in upstate New York, Ursula Rosam works out of Syracuse, and it's had the closest contact with the counties that are most affected by rural health problems. And with that, do we have any time for questions? I think we do.
Yes, we do. Just a moment. Let me see if there's any. I don't see any questions here in the chat. If you'd like to unmute your your mics. We'd like to open the floor for any questions here.
Hi, this is Sarah. I'm wondering what your strategy is to address the unemployment of thousands of insurance companies workers who are based in New York, and sort of what the vision of the New York Health Act is about that.
Excellent question. I'm sorry I had to bring it up in the slideshow, but I was hoping it would come up in the Q&A. Yes, there are going to be a lot of people losing their job. We estimate 150 to 200,000 will be accessed from billing and insurance offices in hospitals, clinics, and doctor's offices. The New York Health Act has a section that talks about funding for retraining and employment services for all of those workers, including extended state unemployment benefits. And all of this will extend out for 2 years in an effort to re-employ those people who lose their jobs. Some of them will continue to work because there'll be expanded services. Some will find jobs in similar industries that deal with office services and so forth. According to the economist who worked on our bill, generally within 2 years, most people in the administrative line of work will be re-employed. But it's definitely a problem. It's a serious problem. The sponsors of the legislation take it seriously. And I might say it's even a bigger problem in rural New York, because the hospitals are often the largest employer in a given town or county.
Yes, right.
There aren't necessarily a lot of jobs available to people who get laid off of those hospitals. On the other hand, rural areas have general deficiencies in services, and we would hope that we'd be able to re-employ a lot of these folks doing outreach, care coordination, and other services. I would point out that the bill requires that every individual enrolling in this program choose a care coordinator, usually a primary care physician. This wouldn't be a gatekeeper. It would be somebody who's available to give advice and guidance on how to navigate the healthcare system. Many care coordination services use outreach facilitators. That is to say, non-medical personnel who keep track, particularly of people with chronic conditions or multiple conditions. And in the process of re-employing billing clerks in the rural areas, we would hope that some of them can get employed as care coordinators and outreach coordinators in those rural areas. So it's a big problem, it's a serious problem, but it's recognized by the sponsors and is included in the legislation.
Here we have a question from Bob Hunt on the line. How does this plan differ from the ones Vermont tried to implement but determined they couldn't afford?
Another good question. There's several parts to that question. I think the financial base in Vermont is much, much lower than New York State. New York State is a relatively wealthy state with an income tax base that can support this type of a program. Vermont simply didn't have that kind of a base. In addition, it wasn't really a full a single-payer plan. It was missing a lot of the services that we were talking about, and was missing a lot of the savings. However, the William Shao, the Harvard economist who helped design the plan and studied the plan, said there was a path to implementing the program in Vermont. It became clear that Governor Shumlin, saw that as politically precarious and did not want to continue the process. So it's still an issue in Vermont. It's an open question, but I think politics and the income base in the state of Vermont created that problem. Thanks for the question.
All right. Any other questions? Remember to unmute your mic or your phone if you have a question for Dr. Moss.
Mm-hmm. There is a chat question.
Yep, I just read that.
I suspect that a lot of the folks on the call have plenty of stories they can tell about problems that exist in the current healthcare system in rural New York. If you're interested, I would urge you to contact the Campaign for New York Health. We publish, we've collected about 2,000 stories, and we've published them and we use them to highlight the problems with the current system and to make the case for the need for the kinds of reforms that we're talking about. If you'd like to share those stories, I urge you to contact Katie or Ursula, as indicated on the last slide. They'd love to hear from you. And one of the problems we have politically, of course, is that rural counties are largely have state senators and state assemblymen who are Republicans and who pretty much ideologically are opposed to any further expansion of government intervention into health. And, you know, we understand that there are different philosophies on this issue. But it's clear that the needs of rural New York are very, very high, and to the extent to which government can play a role in improving that, I think it would be also helpful to, you know, to urge legislators in the rural areas to read the bill, to talk to the sponsors of the bill, and to, if we can't win them over, at least we can neutralize them and not have them talking on behalf of the insurance industry and the pharmaceutical industry, who are obviously adamantly opposed to this legislation. So, and of course, I'd be happy to follow up with anyone here. If you want to write it down, my email address is hmoss011@gmail.com. I'd be happy to answer further questions or give further information about how to get involved if you're interested in getting involved with the campaign. And that brings us to about 2:00. Any more questions?
All right. I don't think there are any other questions. Again, thank you so much, Dr. Moss, for doing the November NYSAR webinar. Our next one is scheduled for January, and we will get that information out. And again, today is National Rural Health Day, and don't forget to check out the powerofrural.org website. And we thank everyone for joining us today, and we wish you a wonderful afternoon.
And thanks for everything you do out in your communities. Thanks, Sarah, for the invitation. Bye.